Welcome, everyone. This is the eighth and final lecture for Mises Academy Class Econ 730, Keynes, Krugman, and the Crisis. So we've done a lot so far this course, gone through parts of the general theory, explained all sorts of things about the transition from Keynes' work through the ISLM diagrams to the modern new Keynesian approach that tries to integrate micro foundations into it and make it a rational expectations framework. And now what we're doing is going over, specifically focusing on Paul Krugman. Go ahead and advance the slide here, see what we're doing tonight. Going through a lot of Krugman writings on the crisis that we're in right now. So remember, my goal with this course was not simply to make fun of or criticize Keynes and Krugman. I wanted to make sure you guys walked away knowing what Krugman in particular, what his worldview was. So I'm going to spend a lot of time tonight doing that, but I'm also going to try for each topic to give you the Austrian rebuttal to it or perspective on it. Right? But I am going to try to make sure you at least understand exactly what Krugman's position is. Okay, so the first topic is the Obama stimulus package. So here, let me just set the context, and I know a lot of you probably are quite familiar with this, but some of you may not. So let me just make sure I'm not leaving anybody behind. I'm trying to think how to phrase it. Okay, well, first of all, what is this figure one? Let me make sure you guys know what this is. This is the diagram was taken from the economic analysis prepared by Obama's team. So remember, Barack Obama is elected president in November of 2008. He gets inaugurated in January of 2009. So at the time, the unemployment rate was 7% and change in December of 08, January of 09. And so and it had been rising, of course, because the recession was getting worse and worse. Remember, all that the crisis occurred with the failure of Lehman Brothers, the takeover of AIG, that happened in September of 08, and then that's when Bush's Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson was saying they needed $700 billion for TARP, and then that was actually approved in early October, if memory serves. And it was right around that period, too, when the Fed started doing its extraordinary interventions, just buying up all kinds of mortgage-backed securities and everything. The slide should be available. I don't know if we have any TAs logged in right now, but I see someone's asking in the chat box if the PowerPoints are available. They should be soon, but this particular PowerPoint show, I'm mostly going to be talking. There's not too much that you need to have the things local, but they should be available in a few minutes when my TA logs in. Okay, so that's context. So then, you know, the unemployment rate's going up and up from month to month because the recession's getting worse and worse. So the Obama team comes in, and you know, this was a historic election for various reasons, and Obama is viewed by many as being a breath of fresh air. We're going to get this old guy Bush out here. Obama's going to come and roll up his sleeves. People were comparing him to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He was saying Obama to come in and institute a new deal. So this is the context. And one of the components of it was the big Keynesian stimulus package. And the numbers were bouncing around about how much they were going to do. They ended up, the official number they gave at the time was $787 billion. And then later on, the official number for some reason has changed. I don't know why they scored differently. But that was the number they were given at the time. So Obama's economic team, that was headed up by Christina Romer, had an analysis of what they thought the stimulus package would do. Is this came out in January of 2009, because they had, of course, had Congress pass it, then Obama could sign it into law as one of his first acts as the new president. So that's what that's where this chart comes from. So let me go ahead and activate my little pointer. So you can see why this proved later on to be such an embarrassment for the Keynesians in the White House, because what they were saying at the time, remember, unemployment in January of 09 was 7% and change. So they were telling people, look, If we pass this package, yes, it's big. It's $787 billion on top of the $700 billion that was in the TARP package. This will push the deficit well over $1 trillion, which was unprecedented in U.S. history to have a $1 trillion deficit. But they're trying to say, we need this because, look, by our estimates, if we don't pass this recovery package, unemployment might get as high as 9% at its peak. However, if we do pass this admittedly expensive package, unemployment's going to peak at around 8%. And then it'll taper off much more quickly. So you can see the gap in this interim period here between unemployment with and without the stimulus package. So that's the political context in which the new incoming Obama administration sold this package to the Congress and to the American people with these sorts of figures. So at the time when unemployment was 7% and change, for the White House to be warning people, you guys better pass this stimulus package because otherwise unemployment might get as high as 9%, that seemed really awful because already the economy was bad and they were saying it's going to get so bad. Can you imagine unemployment being higher than 9%? And everyone's freaking out. So, oh, we don't want that. So let's by all means pass this $787 billion stimulus package. So why did this prove to be such an embarrassment? Well, because as we all know, they went and passed the stimulus package and unemployment went higher than 10% at its peak. And with all these numbers, I'm referring to the official way that the Bureau of Labor Statistics measures it. Of course, many of you know, in reality, depending on how you define unemployment, the actual unemployment rate could have been as high as 16 or 17% when they were officially saying it was 10%. But the point is, using apples to apples and being consistent with the units, the Obama team said, if we do nothing, the laissez-faire economy on its own might get so bad that unemployment gets to around 9%. And yet with the stimulus package, in practice, what happened is the actual unemployment rate, the way they measure it, broke 10%. So that's why this was such a nightmare in terms of PR for the Keynesians. And the Austrians and other free market people were saying, we told you guys, look what happened. Clearly, the huge deficit you guys ran made the economy worse. Even by your own estimates, the economy turned out worse with the stimulus package than you were warning us it would be if we did nothing. So what more do you guys need in terms of empirical evidence that we're right and you interventionist Keynesians are wrong? Okay, so what Paul Krugman has done all along, he's been saying, I told you guys, why didn't you fools listen to me? I warned you from the get-go that this was going to happen, that you guys were passing too small of a stimulus package. It was inadequate. It wasn't going to get done. And then the Republicans and the conservative pundits were going to spin it as if the stimulus failed. And so now the conservative pundits and the Austrians and all the libertarians and the Chicago school guys are saying that. Krugman is pointing to them and saying, you know, you fools, I told you this was going to happen. So what I wanted to do with this opening segment was just walk you guys through to make sure you understand the sense in which Krugman warned the Keynesians that this would happen and the sense in which he didn't see it coming. All right, because if you had just relied on Krugman's own after-the-fact recounting of the history, you might think that Krugman was saying that he did a better Keynesian analysis and that this episode should not discredit Keynesianism. All it should do is discredit a particular forecast that Romer made, but that other Keynesians were completely accurate in their predictions all along. And so I want to clarify and show that actually if that's not true, all right, that Krugman was no better of a forecaster than the Romer team. So let's just walk through that. So here I'm going to be, for all this lecture, but guys, I'm going to be referring closely to the assigned readings. So if you want to, it'll probably help you if you pull those up on your browser. So if you go to Moodle and log in and go to week 8 and look at the readings and get those up on your tabs, because I'm going to be referring to them, in some cases, line by line as we go through this material. All right, so right now I'm looking at the Krugman blog post, which is from January of 09, called Romer and Bernstein on Stimulus. So we go through it, and Krugman goes, first of all, saying kudos to the new administration because they have honest policy wonks working for them. He means as opposed to the liars in the Bush administration. Okay, and then he says here, okay, so he says, this report, referring to the Romer Bernstein report that has that infamous unemployment chart, this report is written in such a way as to make it hard to figure out exactly what's in the stimulus plan. This also makes it hard to evaluate the reasonableness of the assumed multipliers. So saying, for a given amount of government expenditure or tax cuts, what is the total impact on GDP? Because that's the multiplier. That the Keynesian point is, if the economy is below potential, you get more bang for the buck when the government runs a deficit. If the government borrows and spends $100 billion, you don't just get a $100 billion increase in GDP. If the multiplier is 1.5, you get a $150 billion increase in GDP. So the point was, yeah, $787 billion is a lot to increase the deficit by, but that's going to translate more than dollar for dollar into increased GDP growth. And so that's, you know, it's well worth the price. That was their claim. So Krugman's saying here, but here's the thing. The estimates appear to be very close to what I've been getting, the estimates of the multiplier. So he says, you know, they have the plan raising GDP by 3.7%. I thought 2.5% or so over 2 years. Da, da, da. He says, again, not much difference. All right, and then he says at the end here, even if I use the Romer Bernstein estimates instead of my own, and then he's got a dash, there really isn't much difference. Okay, so what I'm trying to get you guys to see is Krugman agrees with the Romer team's estimates as to how much the stimulus package would increase GDP relative to the baseline. So looking at, if we do nothing, what's the economy going to do? If we intervene and run bigger deficits and have government spend more or give tax cuts without cutting spending, what's that going to do to the course of GDP? So Krugman and the Romer team, they don't have the exact same estimates, but they're close enough that Krugman's saying they're basically the same thing. All right, so there's no difference. So now the only way there could be a difference is if Krugman thinks the economy without any government stimulus is going to do worse than the Romer team does. And this is true. So Krugman says, one more point. The estimate of what would happen to the economy in the absence of a stimulus plan seems kind of optimistic. The chart above has unemployment ex stimulus, meaning without stimulus, peaking at 9% in the first quarter of 2010. So he's talking about right here. It peaks at 9% in early 2010. And coming down throughout the year. The CBO estimates an average unemployment rate of 9% for 2010. So the Obama people are more optimistic than the CBO and a lot more optimistic than I am. All right, so let me just make sure you guys get what he's saying. So here he's saying, look at the Romer team, they're saying unemployment just barely breaks 9% at its worst, at the peak of unemployment, and then it comes back down. And he's saying this is more optimistic than the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, because they have, in the absence of any stimulus, the CBO at the time was forecasting that unemployment on average throughout calendar year 2010 would be 9%. So since it's going to be rising, hit a peak somewhere, and then come back down, if the average level of unemployment throughout 2010 is 9%, then obviously that means the peak is higher than 9%. And just, I mean, that's obvious, but I want to make sure you guys get what Krugman's saying. So his point is CBO is forecasting an even higher peak than just barely breaking 9% if we do nothing. And then Krugman says, and that's a lot more optimistic than he is. So Krugman's point is the CBO is more pessimistic than the Romer team. And I, Paul Krugman, am even more pessimistic than the CBO. Now, Krugman, in this blog post that we reproduced for you here, he never says what his own view of the unemployment rate would be if we did nothing, which we would kind of need to know to be able to say, is Krugman right when he says, oh, I predicted all of this? But the best I could come up with for you guys is this next slide here called Krugman on Baseline Growth. So here, this is from a New York Times op-ed that he had written like a week or two earlier. So this is all from January of 2009. So here's Krugman talking in January of 2009. He says, the CBO says that in the absence of a stimulus plan, the unemployment rate would rise above 9% by early 2010 and stay high for years to come. Grim as this projection is, by the way, it's actually optimistic compared with some independent forecasts. Mr. Obama himself has been saying that without a stimulus plan, the unemployment rate could go into double digits. And that was from January 8th, 2009, that Krugman said that. Okay, so in the context of all this stuff, you know, CBO saying it's going to get it higher than 9, and oh my gosh, some people might even think it might break double digits. Remember, this is all saying if we do nothing. And Krugman agrees with Romer that given the size of the stimulus package, it would reduce the unemployment rate about 2 percentage points. So what I'm getting at here, I'm hoping you guys see my point. Krugman also, put it this way, the only way we could look at the economy and say with the Obama stimulus package, unemployment got as high as 10.2%, I think was the highest it actually got officially. If Krugman thinks that that the Obama stimulus package made unemployment 2 points lower than it otherwise would have been, that means the economy left to its own devices, the unemployment rate would have gone up past 12%, such that, you know, the economy with no stimulus, unemployment would have been 12%. So with the help of the inadequate stimulus, it only peaked at 10%, 10.2%. You guys see what I'm saying? So my point is, with this quote here that I just read to you, there's no way that Krugman was saying he thought unemployment doing nothing was going to be as high as 12%. He was saying it might even be in double digits. But in terms of these things, the difference between breaking 10% and breaking 12% is astronomical. Okay, so, and remember, unemployment was only 7% and change when he was writing this stuff. So to tell people if we do nothing, unemployment might get as high as 12%, I mean, that would have been outrageous for someone to say that. I mean, some doomsayers might have been saying that, but my point is that's not what Paul Krugman was forecasting. So when he says after the fact, hey, it doesn't discredit stimulus spending per se, the fact that the unemployment went up to 10% even though we passed the Obama package, and I warned you guys this was going to happen, just keep in mind what Krugman said. Krugman did not say if we pass the stimulus package, unemployment might get higher than what the Romer team is forecasting will happen doing nothing. Krugman by no means said that. What Krugman was saying, if you go and read that blog post again more carefully, is Krugman was saying even on their own forecast, even using their own numbers, I can't understand why the Romer team is recommending this stimulus package, because they're not reducing the output gap nearly quickly enough. Even on their own forecast, let's go look at this again, Krugman saying, look at, unemployment is still higher than 7% going into 2011. And Krugman thought that was unacceptably high. So Krugman's point is even if unemployment does what this dark blue line is suggesting, the Republicans are still going to spin this as failure. Okay, so when Krugman says, I called this, the only thing he called was that the Republicans were going to point to what actually happened after the Democrats pushed their stimulus package and say this clearly didn't fix the economy. Krugman by no means realize that with the stimulus package, unemployment might actually break 10%. And how awful of a PR nightmare is that going to be? Because A, Krugman had, even though he was more pessimistic than the Romer team about what would happen without a recovery plan, he wasn't thinking they were off by 3 points. And B, he thought the $787 billion plan, he agreed with the Romer team that whatever, however bad the economy is going to be if we do nothing, this Obama package will lower unemployment at the peak by about 2 points. Okay, so we got a lot of material, so I'm going to move on, but I just wanted to make sure you guys understood that when Krugman says, this is playing out exactly how I warned, don't think that he's disagreeing with the Keynesian analysis of the Romer team. He's disagreeing with their belief that politically this package was going to be big enough. And then so Krugman, along with all the other Keynesian forecasters at the time, did not see, we really had no idea how bad of an economy George Bush was handing over to us. Had we realized that, we would have pushed for a bigger stimulus, right? So that's the point. So the Austrians and the Chicago School guys are saying, we've told you guys, running big government deficits and spending money doesn't help the economy any. Look at the economy got worse when you put your medicine in, so really it's poison, and the Keynesians have to admit, yeah, the economy did get worse, but it was in spite of our medicine. That it's a good thing that we passed that package, weak though it was, because if we had done nothing, like you fool Republicans and Austrians said, unemployment would have been as high as 12%, even though before we only thought it was going to be as high as 9%. All right, so the episode in and of itself doesn't prove that the Austrians are right or that the Keynesians are right, because to do that you would need to know the counterfactual. We would need to the only way to do it literally, scientifically, would be if we had a time machine to go back to January of 2009, not pass the stimulus, hold everything else the same, and then see what unemployment did in the absence of stimulus. So the Austrians think it wouldn't have gotten as high as 10%, or most Austrians think that, and the Keynesians think, oh my gosh, it would have been like 12%. And so we can never know that, because the opportunity is past. There's no true experiment in the social sciences. But my point again is just that if you didn't know any better and you were an innocent reader of Krugman's columns and blog posts over the years, you might think that when he says, I called this, it meant his technical analysis differed from the Romer teams, and that's not true. He basically agreed with them in terms of the multipliers, and even his projection of the baseline wasn't that much different from theirs. His point was, even on their own terms, the Romer team was projecting that the stimulus would not fix the economy. Okay, let's move on. The next topic here is Krugman's column, San, Janet, and Debt. So if you want to pull that up and be looking at it as I'm walking you through it. So here, again, let's be fair. I want to make sure you understand Krugman's position. So the context here, what Krugman is reacting against is there were a lot of people who were opposed to Keynesianism, opposed to more government deficits, and they're saying, what in the world? Even President Obama admits that during the housing bubble years, Americans were living beyond their means, and that the reason we're in trouble right now is households took on too much credit card debt, they took out home equity loans, and instead of putting on a deck or something, the house that might have raised the resale value, they went out and bought a boat, or they went out and bought a new car, or they went on a cruise. They were treating their homes as ATMs. And then financial firms also became highly leveraged, borrowing from people in order to invest in speculative things. And so now when the real estate market collapsed, we're in trouble, because all these people who were treating either the real estate itself or derivative contracts like mortgage-backed securities and things that were tied to the ability of homeowners to make their mortgage payments, all those assets suddenly collapsed. And so if the value of your assets goes down and you don't owe anybody any money, you can weather the storm. You're okay. I mean, you're poorer, but all right. But if you owe people money and the value of your assets goes down, then you might go bankrupt. You might be in trouble, right? So your leverage matters. If you're leveraged 10 to 1, then if the value of your assets goes down just a little bit, that can wipe you out. Whereas if you're not leveraged at all, you can weather a drop in the value of your assets much better. Okay, so the critics of Keynesian government deficit spending were saying, wait a minute, we all agree, whether we're Austrian, Chicago School, or Keynesians, we all agree the problem is people took on too much debt, either as households or as corporations, during the housing bubble years. That's a problem. So how can it be that you Keynesians are now recommending the solution to this is to have more government debt? That doesn't make any sense. And then as a separate point, how can you Keynesians say running the printing press is going to help? How can printing more fiat money make us wealthier? That doesn't make any sense. All right, so those are the types of objections that on the surface seem fairly plausible. Like, yeah, if the problem is too much debt, why would piling on trillion more in government debt fix things? It doesn't make any sense. So Krugman is going to now try to show us why those are bad objections. So let's just make sure we get what his point is. So Krugman is walking through this thing that he calls Sam, Janet, and debt. So he says, okay, let's say that there's a little stylized example. Let's say there's two kinds of people in the country, spendthrift Sams, and so for foreign students, the word spendthrift means somebody who is very reckless, who doesn't save, who just borrows and consumes. Okay, spendthrift Sams and judicious Janets. So I mean judicious meaning very wise and prudent and making long-term decisions. So the Sams borrow a lot and consume, live above their income for a while, and then accumulate a lot of debt, whereas the Janets live below their means. So they have a certain income, they consume less than their income, and then with the saving, they lend it to Sam. So now Krugman's point is, in this economy, on net, everything is a wash when you look at the system as a whole. That yes, the Sams are deeply in debt, but that's offset because the Janets have those assets, right? The Sams are in debt to the Janets. And so he's saying, you know, debt per se doesn't make an economy poorer or richer because it all cancels out in the collective. That what, you know, if Sam owes somebody $100,000, yeah, that hurts Sam. He has a debt of $100,000, but that means there's some other person in the economy, namely some lady named Janet, and she has an asset. She says, oh, this guy Sam owes me $100,000. So I'm that much wealthier because I have an asset of him owing me something with a present market value of $100,000, and he's making me, you know, monthly payments on it or whatever the terms of the arrangement are. Okay, so now that's the framework. So what can happen? Now Krugman says, what if there's some disruption in the economy and maybe home prices all go down 20%. So now all these guys, Sam, are in trouble. That maybe their incomes go down for whatever reason, they're in trouble. They realize, oh my gosh, we took on too much debt. We need to pay down our debts to adjust to the fact that our home price just went down. So now Krugman's point is, in the system as a whole, just as an accounting truism, the only way the Sams collectively can reduce their debt is if the Janets are willing to see their assets go down in value, right? So originally, if for every guy Sam owed $100,000 to somebody else named Janet, and you had these pairs, well, if all the Sams now want to collectively reduce their indebtedness down to $60,000, the only way that's possible, the only way that outcome can work, is if all the Janets who originally had an asset worth $100,000 are willing to see their financial position evolve such that when in the new equilibrium, instead of holding $100,000 in assets, now they're only holding $60,000 in assets. Okay, so that's, you know, we got a lot of materials. I can't dwell on that too much, but that is true. I mean, so Krugman's not engaging in a trick. That is correct, right? That's just an accounting principle. So now Krugman is saying, okay, we know that that's what has to happen in terms of the accounting. If all the Sams are trying to pay down their debt, that means the Janets have to be willing to allow their assets to go down in value. So now Krugman's saying, in practice, how would a market economy, you know, what the price signals would there have to be to make people voluntarily choose to do that thing? And he's saying, well, it would have to be, or what would happen is interest rates would go down. And if you think about it, that makes sense, even from a typical Austrian perspective. If the Sams now are saving more, they're living below their means, because think about it, how would Sam pay down his debt? He owes Janet $100,000, and before he was just making the minimum payments every month to keep that debt where it was. And then he decides, because, you know, the value of his house goes down or something, and he realizes, whoa, I'm carrying too much debt relative to my net worth. I feel uncomfortable. I want to solidify my financial position, so let me pay down some of this debt. I don't want to be walking around owing Janet $100,000. I would feel much better if I could only be walking around owing her $60,000. So how does Sam get to that position? Well, obviously, every paycheck, he has to, you know, he's got his same income from whatever his job is or his sources of income. So now he has to consume less than he otherwise would have and use the difference, the extra savings, to pay down that debt. So instead of every month sending Janet just the bare minimum that he owed her to keep the debt at the same level, now he's going to send her additional payments. So Sam is consuming less. He's transferring more of his income every month to Janet, but now here's Krugman's point. What Janet has to be willing to spend to consume that extra payment every month. In fact, she has to consume a little bit more than it, right? Or, well, no, she just has to consume it. Because if she didn't, if she tried to take that money and invest it elsewhere, like to lend it out to somebody else, because Janet said, no, I like having people owe me $100,000. And so, yeah, this particular guy, Sam's trying to pay down his debt, but I don't want to consume it. Let me lend it out to some other guy. Krugman's point is, in the aggregate, that doesn't work out in terms of the accounting, because all the Sams are trying to collectively reduce their indebtedness. So it has to be the case that, on average, the Janet are willing to consume those extra payments while the Sams are working off their debt. Okay, so from Janet's point of view, then, what's happening is she's living above her means, at least for this transition period, that she has the income from her job and she gets the normal dividend payments from Sam, but now when Sam's trying to pay off the principal too, she's going out and spending it at the mall or going to the restaurant. Okay, so Krugman's point is, as long as the Janets were willing to do that, the economy would be fine. The Sams would be living below their means, consuming less than their income, and the Janets would be living above their means, consuming more than their income. So really what would be happening is the Sams would, for example, go out to a fancy restaurant one fewer time per month, and Janet would be going one extra time per month. So the restaurant business wouldn't see a drop in its sales. There wouldn't be a drop in aggregate demand. It's just the particular customers coming in the door would change. Sam would be coming in less frequently, and Janet would be coming in more frequently. And the way that would balance out is that the amount of money that Sam owed to Janet would shrink. Okay, so that, I think, you know, I'm taking you through the story, but I want you guys to get the big picture of what's going on here. Okay, so the point is, how do market signals facilitate this outcome? Krugman's saying when the Sams start trying to save more, that pushes down interest rates. And that makes sense from an Austrian perspective. The supply curve of savings goes up, other things equal, the interest rate goes down. And so now at the lower interest rate, since there's less of an incentive to save on the margin, the Janets should be willing to consume more, right? That the if before interest rates were 10%, that meant if you were going to consume today, you know, if you had $100 and you were thinking about should I blow it on consumption today, you'd say, oh, but if I could do that, or I could defer my consumption, and that means I could consume $110 worth of stuff next year. And so if we were in equilibrium before with that, and Janet, you know, distributed her present versus future consumption decisions until she was maximizing her utility, when the interest rate was 10%, well, now what if the interest rate goes down to 5%? Well, now the penalty on consuming in the present is lower because now the trade-off's different. If you abstain from consuming $100 today and wait a year, you only get to consume $105. So the point is, on the margin, Janet's going to decide to consume more in the present when interest rates fall from, let's say, 10% down to 5%. Okay, so this is, I'm belaboring this just because it's good economics and it's good for you guys to think through this, just to make sure everyone's with me. Okay, so as long as the interest rate has room enough to drop, everything is fine, even according to Krugman. Yep, if the Sams want to lower their indebtedness, that can happen. There's no reason aggregate demand would fall. The Sams would live below their means. The Janets would live above their means. And the interest rate would fall to induce the Janets to be willing to do the reciprocal of what the Sams wanted to do, so that the accounting and the capital accounts and everything would all balance out. And like I said, what would be happening in the big picture is just the Sams would be consuming less and the Janets would be consuming more. But aggregate demand, there would be no reason for it to change. Okay, Krugman's saying, oh, but there's a problem. What if the drop in property values, the thing that in his story was scaring the Sams and making them want to reduce their indebtedness, what if the shock is so severe and the Sams want to reduce their indebtedness by so much that the only way you could get the Janets to be willing to let their own assets get whittled away that by that much is if the nominal interest rate became negative. And then you can see the problem. Right? And so why would that happen? Well, maybe because the shock is so severe and the economy is so bad that everybody thinks the smart thing to do is to save, to build up assets. So the Sams are trying to save and build up assets by reducing their debt, right? Because that, you know, it seems kind of funny. If you owe someone $100,000 and then you pay it off so you only own $60,000, you just saved $40,000. You've increased your net worth by $40,000, even though you might not be used to, that might seem weird to you. Okay, so if you started with nothing, you saved $40,000, and so now you had assets of $40,000 when all is said and done, you guys can see why that would be saving and it would put you in a stronger financial position. Well, it's the same thing if you start out from a negative number. If you start out owing $100,000 and you end up only owing $60,000, you've increased your net worth by $40,000 too. It just, since you started negative, it seems kind of weird. Okay. And not that your net worth was negative because you take into account your income, future income stream, all that stuff. But you get what I'm saying, I hope. All right, so the point is, in a really bad economy like we're in right now, the creditors of the world, the Janets, they don't want to increase their consumption. They don't want to live beyond their means. They're freaked out, too, by the housing collapse. So they're not going to be willing to let their assets run down because that seems reckless. So Krugman's point is market incentives still work. You could get them to do it if interest rates were negative 10%, let's say. And so you realize, I can consume $100 today, or I can consume $90 next year. You guys see how that works? If that were the trade-off, you could see at some point, even the judicious Janets would live above their means today because the trade-off would be such in favor of present consumption with a negative interest rate. you know, make it absurd. What if you could spend $100 today, or if you wanted to wait till next year, you could only consume $2. Well, then a lot more people would live it up in the present if that were the trade-off with a negative 90% interest rate. Okay, so that's what Krugman's point is, that the market price could get the outcome you need so that aggregate demand doesn't collapse. Except you've got this pesky zero lower bound on the nominal interest rate. The lowest interest rate can go is 0%, and so given a severe enough shock, we might be in a situation where we can't reconcile the Sams of the world, their desire to reduce their debt. We can't make the Janets be willing to accommodate that by seeing their own assets drop, that everybody's trying to save too much on net. That's the problem. And then, so Krugman says in this particular blog post, he says, look, I'm not going to spell out a formal model and cross all the T's and dial the I's, but you guys can see how if the interest rate stops at the 0% and it's not, and at that point it's still not low enough to accommodate all these things to facilitate it, the problem would be a drop in total aggregate demand. Because remember, the Sams, in order to save, to attempt to save, are cutting back on consumption. They're using their income to try to pay down debt rather than consuming it. But the problem is the Janets are not doing the mirror image of that. They're not consuming above their income in the same amount. So that means total consumption spending is down. And that's the problem, according to Krugman. So now he's saying, what can we do in this situation? He said, well, there's two things. Inflation would work because, first of all, if we expect future inflation, that gives us a negative interest rate in real terms. So even though there's that boundary of the 0% nominal thing that you can't make future consumption more expensive by having a negative nominal interest rate, you can make it more expensive by having a negative real rate. So that we say, okay, you can spend $100 now or $100 in the future, but guess what? If prices next year are going to be 10% higher, well, then that $100 isn't going to buy you as much stuff. So if the expected one-year inflation rate is high enough, even the Janets are going to consume now. They're going to consume now before their money loses its purchasing power. Again, remember, the problem in Krugman's mind is, shoot, the Sams of the world don't want to consume. How do we induce the Janets to make up for that fact? And so one way is if the Janets think there's going to be a big increase in the price level. Another solution, Krugman says, is if the government comes along and the government lives beyond its means. Because remember, in Krugman's analysis, the problem is, shoot, we got all these Sams trying to lower their indebtedness, and the Janets don't want to facilitate it by living above their means. So Krugman's saying, so how about we have Government Gus come along, and he will live above his means. Government Gus will allow the Sams to reduce their well, here's what happens. The Sams are paying off, They're paying extra to the Janets, and the Janets don't want to see their assets go. So the Sams go from owing Janet $100,000 to having $60,000, but the Janets do not want to see their assets drop from $100,000 to $60,000. So what are the Janets with the extra money? Oh, they could lend it to the government. So now the Janets are still fine. Now Sam owes Janet $60,000 and Government Gus owes Janet $40,000. So Janet hasn't reduced her assets. She's still living, she's just consuming her paycheck every period. Sam's happy because now he only owes Janet $60,000. And how is that possible? It's because now the government is more, it has a bigger debt than it did before. All right, so that's the idea. So total aggregate demand didn't need to drop because now the government was picking up the spending that Sam cut. And so there is some points here, and Krugman does talk about it, that you could say, well, wait a minute. but now don't Sam and Janet, as taxpayers, realize they're on the hook for the government's extra debt? And he says, yes, that's true, but he says, you know, the distribution of the debt matters. Okay. So what's the quick Austrian view on all that stuff? Well, if you read my piece, I think it ran this Monday at Mises.org, I spelled out and I said that deleveraging is not bad for the economy. And that, and I had this particular chart here. So now I'm back to the PowerPoint slides. And I was showing that, you see, this blue line is household financial obligations, a percent of disposable income. That went, you know, it rose during the housing bubble years. And then once the crisis set in, it dropped like a rock. And this red line is the personal savings rate, which went all the way down to a measly 1%, but then now it's come up sharply in the last few years. So households are doing the right thing. They are trying to save more once they realize they were in over their heads. And my point in that article was to say that's a good thing. That's not something to be lamented the way Krugman is lamenting it. That when you live beyond your means, the way you fix that is you live below your means. And I said, in terms of, oh, well, that screw up the economy as a whole, is there this fallacy of composition, like the Keynesians would like to argue, where, yeah, for any one household, you're better off if you save a lot and bolster your financial position. But if we all try to do it at the same time, it's self-defeating because we just reduce total income. I argued that, no, that's not true, that there's no fallacy of composition in this particular instance. What's good for one household is also good for the economy as a whole, that when households live below their means, they consume less, that frees up real resources. So now, yeah, the restaurants, they see a drop in their business. It's true. The Sams of the world aren't going out to eat as much, and the Janets don't pick up the slack because the Janets don't want to whittle away their assets either. So, yep, the restaurant industry sees its sales plummet, but so what? That's fine. They lay off workers, and now those workers are free to go do something else, like go dig up more iron ore or go make tractors or go make fertilizer or make drill presses. Right? So they can go, instead of giving people consumption goods like fancy steak dinners that are consumed today and then gone, they can go do things like make capital goods that make workers more productive in the future. Now, there is an issue of coordination. How does the price system make that happen? And we don't have time to get into that right now, but the point is, you know, physically, in terms of the economy as a whole, there's no engineering problem with people deciding to consume less collectively. It just frees up real resources. And so I'd argue that, yeah, you need to tell a story, an equilibration story, about how does the economy reallocate those resources. But we know that societies that have a higher savings rate, it's not like they're forever trapped with an awful economy. No, they tend to have a higher standard of living, and they grow faster because they plow more of their resources into making tools and equipment to make their workers more physically productive in the future. One last point on this, it is true if you set the problem up correctly, it is true just as a matter of accounting that if people on net are trying to save and reduce their indebtedness, the total income may go down. Like I said, depending on how you define your terms and so forth, that might just pop out as an accounting identity. That, you know, think about it, the Sams are, when the Sams don't spend, when they don't go out to eat, oops, that's less income from the restaurants. And then with that money, if they give it to the Janets, and now the Janets don't go and spend it either, well, then that income, in a sense, is lost. So total income for that time period is lower than otherwise would have been. But that's in nominal terms, because now also prices are falling. And so it's, it doesn't follow that in real terms the actual consumption of goods and services is lower. It just means the particular prices change, and that's what in the Austrian story causes entrepreneurs to rearrange the structure of production. You want the prices of the capital goods, or sorry, of the consumer goods to go down. So entrepreneurs reallocate resources to the higher stages. That's how the economy grows over time. So that's part of the process. And it's silly for the government to come in and try to arrest that process, to try to prop up home prices. Right? Home prices were bid up to artificial heights during the housing bubble years. So how are you going to get back to a normal economy? You have to let them fall. Whereas what the Keynesians want to do is everything in their power to keep prices up at those ridiculous levels. Or if their wages went too high during the boom, how do you restore equilibrium? How do you get that glut of workers to get hired again? Their wages have to come down. It has to become cheaper to hire a worker to induce businesses to hire more workers. And yet the Keynesians are doing everything they can to prop up wages. So that just goes along with the general Austrian critique of Keynesianism, that the Keynesians are focusing on macro aggregates instead of looking at individual sectors and how relative prices need to change to induce resources to flow from one sector to the other. Okay, let's move on here. This next segment, Krugman versus Neil Ferguson. So Krugman, of course, was being very condescending to this guy. Ferguson had said at some conference where Krugman was also. Ferguson, I'm pretty sure he's an economist, or I think he's an economist at Harvard. So he's not, you know, some schlub, or maybe he is if you don't like people from Harvard. But Ferguson had said something like, for every dollar that the government spends in stimulus, that's one less dollar available to the private sector. And Krugman was saying that, oh my gosh, I can't believe that we're back in this dark age of macro. These moron Chicago school free market types don't understand the first thing about how an economy actually works, and they're confusing account ontologies. Right, so we're going to get into all this stuff. So let me, I think I'm getting ahead of myself. What Ferguson had said, excuse me, I apologize. I'm talking about the next set of slides. Right now, what Ferguson had said, I think Ferguson said what I just said also, but the thing that Krugman's talking about in this particular article is that Ferguson had warned when the government runs a big deficit, that's going to push up interest rates. And Krugman said, no, you idiot, you don't understand what Keynes and John Hicks taught us in terms of how you deal with interest rates, especially in the context of a liquidity trap. And so here again is another case where Krugman has been saying for years, I and Brad DeLong and the other Keynesians got this right. You idiots at the Wall Street Journal and University of Chicago got it totally wrong. So I want to walk you guys through to make sure you understand what Krugman's point is. Okay, so Krugman first of all says, so here I'm looking at this is the standard loadable funds model. This would be like what you'd see in Roger Garrison's text or a regular book, economics textbook. So here it's a typical supply and demand framework, and we're talking about the market for loanable funds. So here the price is the little r, which is the real interest rate, and then this is the quantity of both supply, of savings and investment. So the idea is up. You've got your supply curve of savings, which is upward sloping, right? The higher the interest rate, other things equal, the larger the quantity of savings that savers will provide to the loanable funds market. On the other hand, you've got your downward sloping investment curve. The lower the rate of interest, other things equal, the larger the quantity of funds that firms want to borrow to invest in, you know, their projects or whatever. Okay? So that's straightforward. And then, of course, wherever they intersect, that's the equilibrium market real rate of interest, and that quantity gives you the amount of dollars that are saved and borrowed. Because obviously if one person's saving, somebody else has got to be borrowing it. Okay, so in this framework, the typical supply side kind of guy, typical free market person who was analyzing the possibility of trillion-dollar deficits in early 2009 was slapping their head saying, oh, that's going to push up interest rates. Because, look, it depends how you can phrase it either way. You can either say that that's going to push out this I curve, right? So instead of being this I curve right here, it'll be like over here. And so that means the equilibrium interest rate will be higher. Or if you want to view it as it will reduce the supply of available savings, it'll make the S-curve shift to the left. So economists might differ on how they interpret S and I, whether it's total or whether, you know, how it nets out the government. But the point is either you're reducing the amount of savings available to the private sector so that the S-curve shifts left, driving up the equilibrium interest rate, or you're increasing the demand for savings if that I includes deficit spending by the government, which means the I curve shifts to the right. So either way, that should push up interest rates. And that's like the familiar crowding out argument, that the government borrows money, so there's less money for the private sector, it crowds out private investment. That's the idea. So Krugman's saying that's hogwash. And here's why. He says, okay, and this is kind of a subtle point, Krugman's saying it's not that we're rejecting the supply and demand model for loanable funds. Rather, what we're saying is you Chicago school types are using it improperly. Because, of course, you can, in economics, everything is supply and demand. So the Keynesians are not saying supply and demand doesn't work when it comes to interest rates, but their point is there's a subtlety going on that you idiot Chicago school guys are missing. So here's what Krugman's saying. He's saying the supply and demand for loanable funds, as John Maynard Keynes taught us, is dependent on GDP. So let's say we had an original supply and demand curve. So that's this S1 here and this original I1. So here, this is the original equilibrium interest rate, right? Now Krugman says, suppose, though, that this occurs at less than full employment, and now somehow we go to full employment, so GDP goes up, total employment goes up, what happens? And the point is both the supply and the investment curves or demand curves shift to the right, but he says typically we would expect the supply curve to shift more. And I'm actually not sure why he says that, but let's just take his word for that. So if S1 goes way out to S2 and I1 goes out just a little bit to I2, the point is at the new intersection where S2 crosses I2, that happens at a lower point than the original intersection, right? So that lower dotted line is the new interest rate compared to the higher dotted line. Okay? So we're still using the loanable funds diagram here, that model of a price and quantity and then an upward sloping supply curve and a downward sloping demand curve. Krugman said you can still use that if you want, but you have to do it properly. And you have to realize that the supply and demand for loanable funds crucially depends on what is the level of output or what's the level of total income in the economy, and that can make both curves shift. So that is one way you could derive, next slide, the IS curve. So remember, the IS curve looks, the real interest rate is the y-axis, but the x-axis is not the quantity of saving. Rather, it's GDP. Those are what the axes are on an IS curve, and that's downward sloping. So what does that mean? That's saying, look, the higher GDP is, the lower the interest rate is, because the IS curve is downward sloping. So Krugman's point, flip back a slide, is to say you can, he said that's not the way, normally when we derive an IS curve in a macro textbook, we don't do it this way, but he's saying you could do it this way if you wanted to. It's the same information. It's just this is a strange way to get at the answer. So Krugman's point here is the Chicago school guys who think in terms of a market for loanable funds, in terms of simple supply and demand for bond analysis, you can use that framework if you want, and Paul Krugman can still derive my downward sloping IS curve. It's just, it's kind of complicated. It's like this diagram right here, where I say, give me an original S1, an original I1. That gives me an interest rate that's way up here, and real GDP, well, you don't know what real GDP is from this diagram, but if I'm just telling you, now increased GDP, what happens? Well, people have higher incomes, they save more, and they also are willing to invest more, but if for some reason the supply increases more than the investment increases, that's going to push down the equilibrium interest rate. So we see, using this framework, we can get the same conclusion that higher GDP is consistent with a lower real rate of interest. And that's exactly what this downward sloping IS curve shows us, that if you increase real GDP going to the right, the real interest rate falls going down. Okay, so now Krugman is saying the problem is, and why Neil Ferguson was wrong, is what happens if we're in a situation like we are in this diagram where the full employment level of GDP occurs where the interest rate would have to be, where the real interest rate has to be negative. Then that can be a problem, because what if inflation, price inflation, is low such that in order to achieve the desired level of the real interest rate being negative, you would need a negative nominal rate? Nope, you can't have that. All right, so for example, let's say that this intersection point right here is negative 5. So saying the real interest rate, if this is what the IS curve looks like, to get this level of output, which by assumption is the full employment level, that's how big GDP would have to be to keep everybody with, to keep a job for everybody. If it would take a negative 5% real interest rate and price inflation is only expected to be 2%, well, then that means, oh, shoot, the nominal interest rate would have to be negative 3%, but that's impossible because the lowest the nominal rate can go is 0. Okay, so that's why, let me just show it to you this way. Krugman's saying, look, I can show you this thing. If you think the IS curve is Keynesian superstition, fine. I'll do it in your loanable funds diagram. It would look like this, where the intersection that achieves equilibrium between the quantity of funds saved and invested happens to be where the real interest rate would be negative. So Krugman is saying, in this framework, if the Fed, for some silly reason, because they're scared of Ron Paul, is unwilling to inflate enough, to promise enough future inflation, we'd be stuck. The economy would try to clear the loanable funds market. Interest rates would fall, but we would get stuck. And incidentally, Krugman's being a little bit sloppy here, or not sloppy, but again, this little r, that means the real interest rate, whereas the little I is the nominal interest rate. So it's not a big deal, but I'm just pointing it out for the purists in the crowd. Technically, you to look at this, to know if the economy is stuck, you need to know what the inflation, expected price inflation rate is to be able to tell, can the economy achieve this desired negative real interest rate? But the point is, if expected price inflation is too low, then you can't. And so the idea is interest rates fall as low as they can, but then they're stuck. So if nominal interest rates are 0 and expected price inflation is 2%, that means the real interest rate is negative 2. So what if negative 2 only puts you right here, let's say? So you still got that gap where S is to the right of I, because the real interest rate can't go any lower because, shoot, the nominal rate is 0 and Bernanke is intimidated by Ron Paul and won't print enough money. All right, so last point on this Neil Ferguson thing. So Krugman is saying, yeah, Ferguson is right. If the government runs a big deficit, that will either push the I curve to the right or push the S curve to the left, whichever way you want to frame that. But notice, for small moves here, if the original intersection point was well below that 0 line, even after you move the S curve to the left or after you move the I curve to the right, the new intersection is still going to be below the 0 point. So we're not going to observe interest rates going up. Everyone get that? Let me just say that one more time. Krugman is not denying that if you're going to model interest rates using supply and demand analysis in this typical loanable funds diagram, he's not saying that that diagram is wrong. He's just saying it can give you the wrong answer if you don't use it properly. and said, so in our current environment, the way you want to draw your supply curves and demand curves for loanable funds is to have the intersection point be well below the zero level. And then once you realize that, you realize, there's a constraint, and what we observe out there is rock bottom interest rates. That's not the market clearing level. It's hitting that zero lower bound. It wants to be even less, but it can't. So now, if the government runs a bigger deficit, which normally would push up interest rates, we might not see interest rates actually go up because they're still just trying to get back up to the zero level. That's the idea. And so Krugman's saying, I and other Keynesians predicted this back in 2009. All the other people warning about sky-high interest rates thought we were going to see big spikes because of all the government borrowing, and they were wrong and we were right. Okay, let me move on here. This dark age of macro, this is kind of neat. So here, again, it's the same concept. Krugman is saying, why is he saying it's a dark age? Because, and this is, just shows how arrogant he is and everything and condescending. Krugman says in his column, what was it about the dark ages? He said, it's not, the reason we call it a dark age is not simply that they knew less than we do. He said, after all, in the Bronze Age, those people knew less than we know. He said, so why was it a dark age? He said, because knowledge was lost. In the medieval period that we now call the dark age, they had lost the knowledge of the Greeks and the Romans because of the barbarian invasions or whatever. And so Krugman is saying the reason this is the dark age of macro is not simply that these idiots out of Chicago are telling the government bad advice, giving the government bad advice. It's that they are failing to incorporate insights that we gained back in the 1930s, for crying out loud. We know better than this. In the 30s and 40s, we learned things, and then we refined them, the Keynesians did, and these idiots at Chicago lost all that information. So that's why it's the dark age. Okay, so now what's going on? Krugman is saying guys like Cochrane out of Chicago and Eugene Fama out of Chicago, some of their popular pieces criticizing the stimulus package were saying things that I'm sure many of you guys have heard, stuff like, you know, look, government spending can only come from one of three places, either taxes, borrowing, or inflation. In any of those things, it's just sucking resources away from the private sector. So, yeah, the government can raise income in one spot of the economy, but only by reducing income somewhere else. And so on net, we have no reason to suppose that a big government deficit is going to boost GDP, because it's like trying to fill up a swimming pool, putting a bucket in the shallow end, and then pouring it out into the deep end and thinking you're going to raise the level of the pool. Right, so that's what that kind of analysis that Krugman's taking on right here. Okay, so he says, so the problem is Krugman's saying those guys are reasoning from an accounting tautology in trying to come up with economic causality. So it's kind of ironic because that's what I accuse Krugman of doing at times and other Keynesians, that they'll write something like a national income accounting equation that's true if you are okay with what the variables are supposed to define, and then they try to show, see, all we have to do is increase government spending and that will raise GDP, when no, that doesn't follow at all. One of the other variables in the equation could go the other way to keep the equation consistent but not show any benefits of government spending. All right, so let me just make sure you guys get what Krugman's saying here. So here you go. I have to go, we're kind of running low on time here, so I'm going to go through it quickly. So this slide here, I'm giving you the derivation. So this top line, y equals c plus I plus g. So y is total output, c is consumption, I is investment, and these are in the private sector, and g is government spending. And also normally you would put net exports, but let's not deal with that. Let's just assume it's a closed economy, or if you want, it's the world as a whole. We're not trading with Mars, and so there's no net exports. But we can also write the total income, which is another, you know, total output, same thing as total income, equals savings, private savings, plus private consumption plus taxes, right? Because if you're an individual household, you have a certain income, what do you do with it? You can consume it, you can save it, and you have to pay your taxes with it. So the point is you aggregate that for all households in the economy, and that's how you get this equation. So now let me, so we have two different equations for Y. Let me set them each other, and we get this. And then the C's cancel, and we're left with this. So this is an accounting identity. That private investment spending plus government spending has to equal private household saving plus tax payments. And, you know, don't worry so much about the economics of that. Just, you know, you can see how I got that just using algebra. Okay, so using this kind of accounting tautology, the guys from Chicago, the free market guys who were against the Obama stimulus package, Krugman says they were using arguments that kind of ran like this. They were saying, okay, we've got that, we know that I plus G has to equal S plus T. So if government spending goes up, then I is going to go down. Right? Because if households are saving the same and tax payment, you're not increasing taxes, and you want the government spending to go up, well, that's got to come from somewhere. Where is it going to come from? It's going to come from lower investment spending. Okay, so that was the gist of it. So Krugman saying they were looking at this accounting tautology and trying to say there's no free lunch. If the government spends more, it's got to come from somewhere. And Krugman saying even though that equation is true, the way they were using it was invalid. And so that's now we're back at this diagram to show you why. So he said this is coming from a standard macro textbook. He says the problem is that S plus T and I plus G can be dependent on the level of output, the level of total income. So he said S plus T in particular is upward sloping in terms of GDP, because GDP is this is the x-axis in this case. So that's why this S plus T is upward sloping. So yes, the accounting identity tells us S plus T has to equal I plus G. That's true. So we're going to be at this intersection point. Accounting forces us to be there, right? I mean, this is, remember, this line here is the line I plus G. This line is S plus T, so the intersection is where S plus T equals I plus G, and we know they have to be equal because of accounting. So Krugman is saying, looking at this diagram, we can see, suppose that G goes up, government spending goes up. He said, what's going to happen? Does that mean that I goes up? He said, no. That doesn't need to happen. This diagram shows it. Suppose G goes up and I stays the same. Well, then this horizontal line here, it shifts up. So just shift that whole line up. And then, you know, I can't do it here, but you can see then it would intersect the S plus T line further to the right, meaning GDP would go up. So instead of having this dot dash line here, there would be a new dash line, let's say, right here. As we shifted that horizontal I plus G line, if we just shifted it straight up an inch, then that's perfectly consistent. Okay, so Krugman's saying you still obey the identity. It's still true that S plus T equals I plus G, but where Fama and Cochran and these guys from Chicago go wrong is they assume that S plus T is fixed, regardless of government spending, and Krugman says not so. If you're in a liquidity trap, government spending goes up, and that pushes up GDP, and so now with higher GDP, people are sitting, you know, the absolute amount of saving is higher and tax payments are higher. So S plus T is higher because the S plus T is increasing in GDP. So you just move along the S plus T curve to a higher level of output. And so Krugman is saying you can't use the simple accounting tautologies to prove what these Chicago school guys are trying to say. So what's my response to that? And I got to speed up here because we're running low on time. Krugman is right as far as he goes. It is true you can't use mere accounting to make the economic claim that government spending won't increase real output. So I agree with him there. You can't just use simple accounting to prove that every dollar of increased government spending necessarily reduces private investment by a dollar somewhere else. Because Krugman's right, you have to deal, in order to say that, you would have to prove that increased government spending doesn't increase total output. Because if increased government spending did increase total output, then there's a bigger pie, and it's not clear that because the government's taking more of the pie, that there's less of the pie available for other people. So that's true. And the Chicago school guys and Austrian, and I've said this stuff too, like on the radio, I'd use the argument, just talking to normal people, you know, some guy on the morning talk show, I said government spending can only come from taxes, deficits or inflation. And that's all true, but yeah, to get the conclusion and therefore more government spending just leads to diminished spending elsewhere and doesn't really boost total GDP, you're right, you need more than just mere accounting to get there. But as an Austrian, I would say, okay, you're right, we need more than accounting. How about common sense and standard economic analysis that says politicians paying guys to dig ditches doesn't really increase output? How's that for a supplementary piece of analysis, that having politicians use resources is not as efficient as having private sector people do it? Okay, so my point is Krugman didn't prove the opposite with this. He just showed that Fama and Cochran didn't fully close the deal. He was showing that it was theoretically possible that they were wrong. Krugman didn't actually prove that they were wrong. So this diagram doesn't prove to us that government spending in a liquidity trap actually does raise total output, because this diagram is based on Keynesian theory. Right? So this diagram does not come from mere accounting. Drawing S plus T as an upward sloping function and so on, all that stuff has a Keynesian model behind it. The only thing that the accounting is doing is telling us that this intersection point is the relevant one, that we have to be at the intersection where S plus T equals I plus G. That's what the accounting tells us. But the shape of these curves and everything, and why when you increase G, you would shift that curve up. Because what if it is the case that increasing government spending happens to lead to a one-for-one drop in private investment spending? Well, then boosting G wouldn't shift this curve up at all. It could even be worse. Using the same diagram, but having an Austrian theory, what if I said increasing government spending leads to a 2-to-1 drop in investment spending? Well, then, if I boost G, that means I goes down by even more, so that means I plus G needs just to fall down. And then we move to the left on the S plus G curve, meaning GDP drops. Okay, so again, and then we got to move on. The point here is all Krugman is really showing is that from accounting tautologies alone, you can't derive conclusions about what will happen to the economy, to the level of real output and employment, from changes in government spending. And he's right, you can't. But my point is, it's Krugman's Keynesian theory that tells him increasing G boosts output. And for all we know, the Austrians are right to say, no, increasing G reduces output, measured in real terms, in terms of, you know, actually satisfying consumer preferences. So this framework is entirely consistent with the view that not merely is it a wash, but actually it makes us poorer. It could increase unemployment if government spends more, runs bigger budget deficits. Okay, so that's what Krugman's subtle point is, and that's my response to it. Okay, hang on, let me just jump ahead of here and see. Okay, we're running low on time. I'm going to just be very brief. So this myth of austerity, here the what's going on is there was a big push, even among people that I was surprised, like what was it? Was it the IMF? No, I think it was the World Bank. I'm getting my globalist organizations mixed up here, but one of those groups, I think it was the World Bank, but it could have been the IMF, but I think it was the World Bank, came out with a surprisingly free market-esque analysis that went through historically and pointed out cases of successful austerity, meaning where governments were deeply in debt and they turned things around. They either cut spending or they slowed the rate of the growth in their spending so that revenues increased faster, so that they reduced their budget deficits. And that, you know, they went from having their debt grow, their debt to GDP ratio was growing, and they turned things around so that it shrank. So in some countries, it was just that it wasn't that they actually ran surpluses, but it was that their GDP grew faster than their nominal debt, so the ratio shrank. But in some countries, they actually were running surpluses and paying off some of their debt while their economy was growing, so their, you know, ratios dropped like a stone. So they went through and analyzed these historical cases, and they were showing that, look, in a lot of these cases, austerity seemed to have worked, that the country was mired in a recession. Finland was the best example that I saw when I looked at the paper, where the unemployment was high, then the government cut spending and started paying off its debt, and unemployment was falling throughout the period. So that they, you know, it looked like the austerity went hand in hand with an economic recovery, which is the opposite of what the Keynesians are telling us. The Keynesians tell us the last thing in the world you want to do is cut government spending when you have high unemployment, that you're just going to, you know, cause a double dip. And yet there are these historical cases, Finland, Canada, some other places where, no, we've got countries here that they were in a situation that seems to be like we're in right now, where, you know, their tax revenue was way down, they had high unemployment, and what did they do? They cut spending, and then that reduced their deficits, and they seemed to pull out just fine. They weren't mired in a decade-long depression the way the Keynesians are warning us. So Krugman's general response to that, we thought that was kind of silly or funny, amusing, is he went through every single case and came up with some little, you know, some explanation to explain it away. So like with some of the cases, he would say, oh, well, it's because, look at their central bank lowered interest rates. So yeah, other things equal, the cut in government spending would have hurt their economy and pushed up unemployment. But since it happened simultaneously with their central bank easing monetary policy, that masked the harmful effects of the austerity, so that on net, aggregate demand went up. That yet the government cut spending, that would have reduced aggregate demand, but the central bank cut interest rates, so that stimulated investment and stimulated private consumption spending, and so that more than offset the drop in the government's spending. And so that's why the economy pulled out. And Krugman's saying, but we can't do that now because interest rates are already at zero. So he said, so any of those historical examples don't count. They're not relevant. And then other cases, I think like Ireland was one of them. That's what this picture is. This is a picture of lovely Ireland. He says Ireland isn't a good example because Ireland, yes, it had a successful recovery even though it was cutting its budget, but it was accompanied by an export boom, that its export sector took off. And so that's, you know, remember Y equals C plus I plus G plus net exports. So if your net exports take off, you can do fine, your economy can grow. He said, but obviously the world as a whole, we can't use that strategy now because we're not trading with Mars. It's not that Earth can start exporting more to Mars. He's saying individual countries can devalue their currency. You know, so their government, for example, yeah, the United States, if we balance the budget next year, we could survive that if we value the dollar so that foreigners wanted U.S. products because it was so cheap, right, because their currency was so much stronger against the dollar. And so they bought all of our stuff. So the demand from foreigners for all of our stuff would go through the roof. So even though they're trying to balance budget, aggregate demand in the U.S. wouldn't collapse because foreigners would fill the gap. So Krugman's saying, yes, any individual country right now could deal with contractionary and fiscal policy if they were willing to debase their currency. He said, but the world as a whole can't do that. We can't all devalue against each other. We can't all increase net exports. That's his point. So, you know, what's the response? I've said a few things on this. One is just, it's hilarious. Krugman doesn't see what his overall strategy is. Krugman has no examples in history of his program working. There's no case where there was a country that was in an awful recession that ran humongous deficits and then was in a recovery 18 months later. There is no such case. When you ask Keynesians, point me to cases where your policies worked, they'll point to countries in the 1930s. They'll say, look at FDR. He came in, started running deficits that were bigger than Hoover, and look at the improvement in the U.S. economy. Or look at World War II. All right. So there, you know, they're pointing at the U.S. in 1936 when unemployment was still in the double digits as evidence of how great their policies are. And the World War II, you know, Bob Higgs has done work on that. That's a very misleading period in general because, yeah, government spending was real high, but private was worse than at the depths of the Great Depression. All right, so the Keynesians cannot point to an actually healthy economy to show the success of their policies. At best, they point to economies that are still awful, but they just aren't as bad as they were like 2 years before. In contrast, the people pushing austerity can point to, you know, 5, 6, 7 examples from different countries, different time periods, different circumstances where a government cut spending and then had a recovery a while later. And so Krugman just has to go through and come up with some particular reason that, oh, well, no, that the reason that, and instead, you know, so the point is, what would the world look like if we were right and he was wrong, than to show that he's got no examples of his policies actually working. He's always got to use hypothetical counterfactuals, right? Because he's going to say, well, yeah, unemployment was still 14% under the New Deal, but it would have been 20% if FDR had done nothing, right? So that's the way he proves that FDR did a great job, is that he's saying how awful the economy would have been had FDR done nothing. And then with the apparently successful austerity measures, because of the other way around. He said, oh, no, it wasn't because of the austerity. It was because of the monetary policy or whatever, or the export boom. Okay, so that's my point. It's like every time his medicine is tried, the patient is still sick. In some cases where the Austrian medicine is tried, the patient is walking around playing basketball the next day, and Krugman, you know, has to come up with a theory to explain all those cases. And the point is, at some point, don't you decide that, you know, maybe my worldview is totally wrong. Maybe government spending doesn't boost the economy. But this is the social sciences. We can't have a controlled experiment. Krugman could be right, right? I can't prove that he's wrong using empirical evidence. Maybe it is just dumb luck that every time Keynesian remedies are tried, the economy is so bad that the economy is still awful even after they've been tried and even after they didn't do enough. Maybe that's been the case every single time. And maybe it also is the case that we have 5, 6, 7 examples where harmful austerity was imposed, but coincidentally it was offset by other things. That, maybe that's true. It just seems like kind of coincidental that that keeps happening. Okay. Let's move on here. I'm not even going to talk about the CPI stuff because we're over time already. Okay, the Krugman versus Murphy. On the one hand, I think it's okay that I'm not going to elaborate on too much because I did my best to spell it out in that article. What do I want to say? Well, first of all, the one thing I wanted to make sure you guys realize is, let me just point out to you, where is it? Okay, so I'm looking at Krugman's column, Great Leaps Backwards. So this is the one where he acknowledged me. In case you guys are curious, I would like to be able to say that it didn't affect me to know that Paul Krugman linked to me and said I was smart, but I'll be honest, I mean, I was like, oh my gosh, he linked to me. I when I saw that, my friend sent it to me, and I forget what my friend's email was, but he didn't say Krugman links to you. He said something that was more ambiguous, like, you're in the game, go get him or something, and I didn't know what he meant. It didn't occur to me, and I could see it was a Krugman blog post, you know, from the URL, but not my wildest dreams that I think he was giving to me, so I clicked it, and like I saw it, and I actually like, walked out of my office to like calm down to savor it, and then I walked back in and read it, right? So in case you guys thought that I was bigger than that, no, I'm not. I'm just that petty. Okay, so what the thing I want to point out to you is here, so Krugman's point, to his credit, or you could say to my credit, either way, Krugman no longer could say that the Austrian theory was pure nonsense. All right, with that little sushi article, which is what he had read and was responding to, you know, I walked through a stylized example with numbers to show a little fable of this is what the Austrians are saying. And so Krugman could not deny that. All right, so he couldn't just say you guys are nuts, because before he had been denying that. If you go and, you know, it wasn't assigned for this class, but if you click on the link to the thing he's linking up for me, the so-called sushi article that was called The Importance of Capital Theory, with the official title we gave it at Mises.org, if you look at the stuff Krugman was saying there, it's ironic. He was doing the same thing that he was accusing the Chicago guys of. Krugman was using accounting on tautologies to try to show that the Austrian story didn't make any sense. And so I walked through and showed that he was wrong, that the accounting tautologies don't prove what Krugman thought they proved, and then I gave that little fable just to drive the point home, to say, look, I can prove to you that I'm right. Let me tell you a story and show you with numbers. Okay, so now in this pose, Krugman, to his credit, is actually backing off. So I don't know if you guys caught that, but here Krugman's making concession. So before, he was saying, as a matter of accounting, the Austrian story doesn't make any sense. Now he's saying, oh, okay, I get what the Austrians are saying. Yes, that's theoretically possible. And he goes even farther and says that's also what happened in China during the Great Leap Forward. So those are two huge concessions. He's saying it's theoretically possible what these Austrians are talking about, and historically, sometimes that is what's going on. And now Krugman's fallback position, his defense, is to say, but that's not what's going on with modern market economies when they get into a bad slump. So the Austrians, so now Krugman's reduced it to an empirical question, whereas before he was saying we were just crazy and didn't understand accounting. And now he's realizing, oh, it's just an empirical question, and he puts the ball back in my court saying, where's your evidence that your theory is more explanatory than my theory? Because, you know, now he realizes my theory, the Austrian story, is internally consistent. Whereas before, he was saying he wasn't even giving us that. Okay. So one thing here, let me just point out, I'll turn over to your questions, is that I thought was hilarious, just to show that as clever as Krugman is, and as well-read as he is, because he does read a lot of stuff and various things, just look at here how he doesn't really get the Austrian story. Because look at what he says. Okay, he says, why is there such a strong correlation between nominal and real GDP? Why is there overwhelming evidence that when central banks decide to slow the economy does indeed slow, and on and on? All right, so there, just think of the irony. Krugman is saying, you Austrians, okay, your story is theoretically possible, but empirically it doesn't match the facts. How can you Austrians explain that when the central bank raises interest rates, that causes a recession, when not only can we Austrians handle that, that's part of our canonical story. The story we tell is the central bank lowers interest rates, that causes a boom, prices start rising, the central bank gets nervous, raises rates, and then that causes the bust. It's the Krugman saying, if you Austrians are right, then how can you explain when the central bank raises interest rates, there's a bust? You mean, make sure you guys get that. When I read that, I was like, what are you, insane? Okay, so anyway, so clearly he doesn't get the Austrian story, and that's, in case you're wondering, that's why my reply to him was so long, is I realized I can't assume that the reader is going to know the Austrian story, so that's why I spelled everything out. So on the one hand, it was probably long and some people didn't bother reading it, but on the other hand, those people who did give it a chance, you know, I hoped to show them, I had to give them all the pieces, because I realized Krugman still, even though he apparently read that Sushi article, didn't get the broader Austrian theory. If he thought empirical evidence that central banks could influence the economy was somehow a strike against the Austrian theory, which says central banks can distort the economy. All right, why don't I turn over to your guys' questions then at this point. Where am I here? And Will, since I'm late, we can go like 10 minutes if you guys have any questions, but I got to close this because I have a class right after this. You're just logging in right now into the questions. So my, while this is coming up here, I mean, just my overall view is Paul Krugman is a very smart, clever guy, but I think, you know, his framework is totally wrong, and it's just, it's funny sometimes to see his mind at work trying to come up with explanations to explain away all the empirical evidence staring him in the face about how wrong Keynesianism is. So it's, I guess what I'm saying is it's not simply that we need to, as Austrians, I don't think we need to be afraid of the data. So yes, as Mises has taught us, you develop economic theory using a priori deduction, but don't worry that a Keynesian is going to be able to throw a bunch of data at you and prove that you're, and make it look like you're wrong, and you just got to retreat to your corner and say, oh, no, I don't trust data. I mean, just looking out at the data, there are no cases of an economy that applied massive deficit spending and then was fine. There are plenty of cases of economies that cuts where the government cut spending and they had a recovery soon afterward. And like with the Obama stimulus package, what would the world look like if they were wrong? Besides saying the economy got worse with their medicine than they were warning us it would be if we did nothing. Isn't that exactly what the world would look like if the Keynesians were totally wrong? And that is what the world looks like. Okay. Let's see. I'm not going to be – you guys have a lot of questions here. I'm not going to be able to catch them all tonight, but I will get them over the next few days. Okay, Paul King says, given the amount of household debt mortgage commitments, when I hear Keynesians talk about an excess of savings, it sounds absolutely ludicrous. So by savings, do they mean short-term cash flow? In other words, people choosing, since the recession started, weekly and monthly to pay down debt? Yes, Paul, that is what they mean. So when they say an excess of savings, they mean in accounting terms, a flow period, like how much did you save this period? They don't mean is everybody walking around with too much net worth and they don't know what to do with it. That's not what they mean. They're saying the Sams of the world are trying to pay down debts and they can't find the reciprocal Janets to allow their assets to fall. And so there's that mismatch. That's what they mean by excess savings. Okay, how about one more question? Okay, another one from Paul. In his article, Self-Defeating Austerity, Krugman seems to be saying that government needs to deficit spend to ensure the tax receipts are high. Is that not the definition of a snake eating its own tail? Okay, that's a really good question, Paul. I never thought of it like that, but let me make sure you guys get what Paul is saying. So the self-defeating austerity Krugman's point is when a fiscal conservative says, hey, oh my gosh, you know, deficits are way too high, we need to cut spending in order to get the deficit under control. So someone might say, next year, instead of, you know, if we do nothing, we just go along the way things are going, status quo, next year maybe we're going to have a deficit of $1 trillion. That's unacceptably high. Let's cut spending by $500 billion so that next year the deficit will only be $500 billion. Krugman's saying, your analysis is wrong. If we cut spending by $500 billion, the deficit is not going to go down by that much because that's going to reduce incomes. People are then, the tax base is going to be smaller, so that means government receipts will be lower than they otherwise would have been. So, yes, spending might go down $500 billion, but if tax revenue goes down by $100 billion because of your austerity measure, then the deficit only goes down by $400 billion. So Paul, you're right. Going the opposite way, what Krugman is saying is, what if we ran a bigger deficit? His point is it doesn't cost as much as you might think at first. That, okay, if we do nothing, the deficit is going to be $1 trillion. What if we spend $500 billion more? Krugman's point is on a static analysis, you might think, oh, well, if originally the deficit is going to be $1 trillion, and now you want the government to spend $500 billion more without touching taxes, the marginal tax rate, without adjusting the tax code, you might think, oh, so that means now the deficit is going to be $1.5 trillion. And Krugman's saying, no, because that additional spending, there's going to be the multiplier effect, people are going to get jobs, GDP is going to grow. Even if we leave the tax code the same, more total revenues are going to flow into the treasury. So let's say it's $100 billion, then actually the deficit will only go up to $1.4 trillion, which is less than what you originally thought. So Krugman is saying, over the long term, we're in such a bad liquidity trap right now, and the multiplier is so high that he thinks it could almost be the case that it almost pays for itself. Now, he's not committed to that, but his point is he's like the opposite of Arthur Laffer, and he even acknowledges that. Because remember, Arthur Laffer's famous thing with the Laffer curve was to say tax cuts at least partially pay for themselves. And I should probably clarify that. I work for Arthur Laffer, so I know Laffer never said that everywhere and always any tax cut always pays for itself. No, he just said you can't use a static analysis that if you lower tax rates, the tax base goes up, and so the revenue fall is less than you otherwise would have thought. And in some cases, it might actually be negative, that you lower tax rates and total tax receipts go up. He said that's possible, but he wasn't saying it's always going to happen. So Krugman is doing the opposite. He's saying if you run a bigger deficit, that boosts the economy, so tax receipts go up. So at the very least, the deficit might go up, but not by as much as you would have thought. And he says, and in some extreme cases, you can even imagine where the deficit goes down because the multiplier is so high. Okay, well, I got to stop there, guys, to get the room open for the next class. Thank you, everybody, for participating. I hope to see you in future classes. I hope you guys learned a lot from this. I hope I clarified without being too prejudicial what Keynes and Krugman's world you are, but at the same time, I hope I also didn't disillusion any of you and make you think that they're right, that I do think that they're totally wrong, but it's when you get into their head, you can see why they think they're right, because it's a very sophisticated worldview. It's just you need to know how to defeat it, and I think the Austrians are the ones best equipped to do it, that really you need the capital structure of the Austrian school to see exactly why the Keynesian focus on macro statistics is so deadly. Okay, thanks, guys. I will be posting the information about the final and so forth, and I'll keep you guys posted that way. Thanks for participating.